Welcome to the Excellence in Training Academy, where trainers come to grow. I'm very pleased to have with us this week Jonathan Hack. Jonathan is a Crown Prosecutor employed by the Alberta Crown Prosecution Service in Calgary, Alberta, a position he's held for almost 30 years. He primarily prosecutes homicides and specializes in legal issues regarding forensic video analysis and expert witness evidence in general. Jonathan has been teaching law at the post-secondary level for over 29 years. He taught criminal law as well as evidence and procedure in the Justice Studies faculty and expert witness testimony in the Forensic Studies program at Mount Royal University in Calgary. Jonathan is currently a sessional lecturer in the Faculty of Management of the University of Lethbridge at the Calgary campus, where he's been teaching management law since 2002. Beginning in 2000, Jonathan became actively involved in researching the law in relation to the use of video evidence in criminal prosecutions and in the training of forensic video analysts from the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom, and other countries. He also trains lawyers on the subject of forensic video analysis law. Since 2000, he's been the principal legal instructor for the Law Enforcement Emergency Services Video Association International, Inc., where he has presented at the FBI Academy in Quantico, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Academy, and various other locations in North America and the United Kingdom. In this capacity, he was an adjunct instructor at the University of Indianapolis from 2004 to 2014. Jonathan researches and writes extensively in the area of forensic video analysis and is regarded as a leader in this area of the law. Jonathan developed a dynamic and highly effective course on expert witness testimony, which is designed for expert witnesses in any field of expertise. Since 2006, this course has been presented at various locations in Canada, the United States, for federal investigative agencies, forensic laboratories, provincial regulatory agencies, provincial and municipal police services, and other professional groups. He also developed and presents a course on courtroom testimony for investigators. Jonathan received his legal education in three countries. He holds a diploma of criminal justice from Mount Royal University, a Bachelor of Science degree with distinction in criminal justice from California State University, a Bachelor of Laws degree from the University of British Columbia, and a Master of Laws degree from Cambridge University in England. And he was appointed as Queen's Counsel in 2006. So, Jonathan, welcome to the Excellence in Training Academy.
Thanks very much, Brian.
Now, you have a tremendous amount of expertise in a variety of areas. What I'd like to talk about is some of the keys to effective expert witness testimony in court. But maybe first we could start by you talking a little bit about your experience in dealing with expert testimony in court. And what was it that led you to develop the expert witness testimony course?
Sure. Perhaps a good place to start is to begin with the definition of what an expert witness is, because not everyone appreciates what's involved in becoming an expert. An expert witness is a person with expertise in a particular field that exceeds the knowledge level of the trier of fact and who applies that expertise in a legal setting. Becoming an expert witness is a significant accomplishment. It means that through a person's education, training, and experience, they've gained knowledge in a particular field of endeavor that is superior to that of the trier of fact, and they're in a position to contribute to the search for the truth, and that is the goal. Over the course of my career, I've led expert testimony many hundreds of times in about 40 different areas of expertise and cross-examined many defense experts. And what became evident to me a long time ago was that police agencies in particular spend an awful lot of time and money training their people how to become the experts, but very little or no time training them to become an effective expert witness. And so I developed my course and present my course to deal with that second aspect, to take that body of knowledge that experts have and make them effective communicators in the courtroom. Because if you can't communicate the valuable information that you have, then the trier of fact loses out. So that's the background for why I developed the course and why it's so important, in my view, to have expert witness testimony training.
Excellent. And that's a great point that agencies spend a lot of investment or invest a lot in developing a level of expertise in people. But most people that get thrust into the role of being an expert witness, it's just that you're now thrust into this role with little or no training in the area and how to give effective evidence. Now, you talked about the role of an expert witness. So can you talk about then some strategies maybe for effective direct examination? So you've led expert witnesses in hundreds of trials in 40 different areas of expertise. Can you talk about some of the strategies for effective direct examination?
Sure. Direct examination is the most important part of an expert's testimony. From a content delivery perspective, this is the moment when the expert gets to explain to the, I'll say the jury because that's easier to conceptualize, they get to explain to the jury everything relevant about their field of expertise, all of the work they've done in a case, and any opinions that have been formed. And this is the component of expert testimony where the expert has considerable control. We've got teamwork. We've got typically a prosecutor who is assisting the expert to get out this valuable information, and we develop a plan in advance. So in terms of some general tips for direct examination, I'll look at power and control to begin with. Unlike in cross-examination, in direct examination, we've got the prosecutor, typically, who wants a witness to be convincing and to get before the court all the relevant information. And so we give the witness time, attention, and deference, and the power of having the floor is readily shared. How that information is presented makes a big difference in how it's received. So some general pointers that I'll comment on now that I think are helpful to comment on is the notion of speaking slowly. When an expert witness is on the witness stand, it's understandable that they would be nervous and they begin to feel that the speed of talking is something that they've lost control over. I've certainly seen that example with civilian witnesses, but with expert witnesses as well, who speak too quickly, they present technical information, and they lose a jury. I've actually had a juror fall asleep during expert witness testimony where the expert witness was speaking so quickly that they just turned off and disengaged. So in terms of speaking slowly, one of the things an expert can do is to take deep breaths, make sure you pronounce key words syllable by syllable, stressing certain syllables, thinking you're being paid by the hour might also help, but it helps to dial down the pace at which you give your testimony. Another thing to consider is tone of voice. We tend to incorporate information that has both a visual and an auditory component. So from an auditory perspective, which is very powerful and the most common thing in court, how we say something can impact how the message is received. An audience will adapt very quickly to a fixed level of volume and tone in an expert witness. And so being mindful of that is something that is helpful. Witnesses that use an arrogant or a condescending tone will rapidly distance a jury from the witness. It's entirely possible that the witness knows more than the attorneys, but that's not something you want to convey by being arrogant or condescending. It's important to use ums and uhs very sparingly. In some training I do in the United States, I had occasion in one moot court to count the ums and uhs that one particular expert witness in training was using, and I stopped counting after I got to 200, and she continued going on and on. So these are things that you can practice. Eye contact is another thing to consider. We in North America tend to believe and trust people who will look us in the eye. We regard them as being genuine. Conversely, people who don't look us in the eye, we tend to think that they're not trustworthy. in the courtroom context, in particular with the jury, maintaining eye contact is important. And I recommend that you spend about two-thirds of your time looking at the jury, not just one juror, but scanning through the jury in random order. And that will certainly cause them to be available for you when you're coming around. When I do opening and closing addresses to juries in murder trials, for example, I always look at all members of the jury and scan through them, and I find that by doing that, they will pay attention to me because they know that I'm looking at them. They don't want to be looking down and missing out. It's just natural to give that courtesy to the speaker. One of the advantages of maintaining that eye contact with the jury about two-thirds of the time is you can pick up on some really valuable nonverbal communication. It's that time that you're going to learn if a juror can't hear you. It's that time that you're going to learn if a juror doesn't understand what you're saying. And it's not because they're going to put their hand up or write you a note. We don't do that in Canada. It's because through their facial expression, they're going to make it clear to you that they're not understanding something. And so that eye contact is a particularly important thing to bear in mind with a jury. With a judge, you're still going to maintain some eye contact, probably not as frequently. So those are a couple of things, some preliminary things, Brian, and perhaps if you like, I can go on to talk about some ways that an expert witness can incorporate to make sure that the jury understands the message that's being brought to them.
Absolutely.
One of the things that we look at is ensuring that the jury understands. We appreciate that the expert witness knows a lot about the case, knows a lot about their area of expertise, but we have to remember that jurors in general don't get to put their hand up and ask questions. They are there simply to receive information. And so expert witnesses have to be very mindful in how they present their evidence. Using technical terms is perfectly fine. I am all in favor of expert witnesses using technical terms that are relevant for their area of expertise. But then when you do that, give a definition so a jury understands what it is that you're talking about. We know you're smart, but we want you to be a good teacher. And that really is the key. I use also what's called a nod test. We all do it. I'm a nodder. If someone is explaining something to me and I understand it, I just nod. I just do. And a lot of people do. When I present evidence in front of a jury, I watch the witness a little bit, but I spend a good part of my time looking at the jury, and I'm looking for them to see if they're nodding at the witness or if they're nodding at me, which is my indication that we are successfully communicating to them. We also have to look at the notion of using clear and precise answers. Avoid using phrases like I guess or I believe, being cautious when giving estimates, giving exact answers, not ballpark answers. Another thing an expert wants to consider is to listen to the question. It's very, very tempting for expert witnesses and all witnesses to answer more than has been asked of you. And it's a poor practice that we want to avoid. So, for example, if the question is, did you prepare a report in this case? The only acceptable answer is, yes, I did, or no, I didn't. I guarantee you that we will ask more questions after that to draw out the further information that we want. If a witness answers more than is asked of him, what you've done is you've tipped off your audience that you're a sloppy listener and that you're inclined to extemporaneously just talk about whatever, and that can set you up for a difficult cross-examination. Another thing to consider is using hypothetical examples and analogies. I'm a big fan of this. Neuroscientists have found that the visual cortex of your brain cannot tell the difference between what's real and what's imagined. And so if you can think of something vividly, really imagine it, the same areas of the brain are activated as if you're really seeing the event. That's why using metaphors, analogies, and rich imagery are powerful ways to paint a picture in the mind's eye, in some cases even more effectively than an actual image. And so transforming verbal information, which is what we do all the time in court, to visual information is very effective. If you can paint a picture in someone's head, then you will get that information better than just through words. And so you can use analogies to explain something as simple as an example I use in class is the movie My Cousin Vinny. Marissa Tomei plays the role, unwittingly, of an expert witness in automotive mechanics or general automotive knowledge. And she's explaining what positive traction is to the jury. And she's talking about limited slip differentials. And the analogy that she uses is, if you're stuck in the mud in Alabama, one wheel turns and the other wheel does nothing. And you see the members of the jury nodding their heads and saying, yep, I get that. And so what she did with that very simple analogy is she explained something, limited slip differential, to a jury in a way that the jury would understand. And these are the types of things that experts can develop in advance. They can have analogies at the ready. They can have examples that they can use, knowing that that's a good way to convey. That's the beauty of so much of expert testimony, is you can practice these in advance. You can have them in your toolbox for when you're on the witness stand. Related to that would be visual evidence, using pictures, demonstrations, and exhibits. Research in education and psychology has shown that different presentation mediums can have different impacts on an audience. Jurors tend to remember and internalize evidence better if there's a visual component. And so the use of video images, still images, charts, graphs, screenshots, toy cars, if you're doing a collision reconstruction, can help get complex points across to a jury. I remember years ago, I did a number of cases with an RCMP collision recon expert, and he would always bring toy cars to the witness stand, and they were very effective at explaining vehicle dynamics. So we could spend 10 minutes talking about what it means for a vehicle to go into yaw, or you can spend 30 seconds talking about that and then demonstrate with a toy car what it means when a vehicle goes into yaw. And again, these are things that we can practice for. Our brains are wired to process visual information such as images very differently than text and sound. And scientists call this multimodal learning. Visual images are processed in different channels instead of one, giving the brain a far deeper and more meaningful encoding experience. And so demonstrations can be very effective. I had done a case one time in front of a jury where a fellow was alleged to have hidden a knife in the sleeve of his jacket. And so to show that this was in fact possible, I asked the witness to demonstrate this on me in front of the jury. So we put the knife up my sleeve with my Queen's Bench robes, and I was sure hoping this would work. And it did work. He showed us what he did with respect to the defendant, and sure enough, there was a knife that fell out of my sleeve, and it worked exactly as he had wanted it to do. So a demonstration is helpful. There was a case out of British Columbia where a prominent lawyer was suing the city of Victoria for assault. He was alleging that a police officer had used excessive force on his client, and he wanted to demonstrate this in front of a jury. And so when I tell you this story, I'll give you the preamble that you got to practice these demos. And in this case, he asked the police officer, the officer who was alleged to have used excessive force, to lay on the ground on his back. The lawyer stood over him and said to the police officer, "I want you to try and kick me in the groin." And the purpose was to show, so he thought, that this was impossible, and that would therefore refute the officer's testimony. His client would win, and everyone would be happy, except for the city of Victoria. So the police officer twice cautioned him against doing this, and the lawyer insisted, nope, I want you to do this. So the officer did, kicked him really hard in the groin. The lawyer fell over and was in considerable pain. And I'll bet that was that police officer's best day of his career. I give you this example to show that if you're going to use a demonstration, for goodness sakes, make sure it works. Demonstrations are great. I love when my expert can demonstrate something because you see the jury, you see them nodding, you see them getting it. And, you know, that's what all of this is about. An expert witness should think of themselves as a teacher, because as a prosecutor, my job is to teach the jury or teach the judge about my case, and I do it by calling witnesses. And so expert witnesses, if they have the ability to teach in a way that is effective and meaningful, they get that information across so much better, and it's so valuable for the people that have to make those important decisions at the end. So, Brian, that's just an overview of some of the things that can be considered in direct examination to make an expert witness a more effective communicator, and that's what this is all about, effective communication.
Excellent, and a lot of great information, and I'm glad you made that point at the end that the expert witness is a teacher, is a trainer, is there to help the jury to get it, to educate them, because as you talked, all these key points are points that also make for effective teaching and training. And it strikes me, too, that it reinforces the importance of that team approach by the prosecutor and the expert, that there's no surprises on either side. I'm assuming that teamwork is key in this preparation to make this testimony be most effective.
It absolutely is. Experts have to meet with the prosecutor, because typically that's the case in law enforcement. They have to meet with the prosecutor at least once or twice in advance to prepare. And it's very frustrating when I hear from experts that it's so hard to arrange those meetings, but you've got to be assertive, you've got to make sure they happen, because those meetings are going to lay out the blueprint for the direct examination. I've always met with every expert witness I've ever put on the stand, and we map out a plan. I've always got a plan, and when we've done that together, then the expert witness knows what's coming, and it just makes for a much more logical, linear, pleasant presentation to listen to. And that's what I meant at the very beginning, that direct examination is the area where the expert has considerable control, because you shouldn't find any surprises in direct examination. At the end of the direct, you should think, I've done a really good job. I've gotten out everything that I want to get out. Now we'll wait and see what happens in cross.
Now, you talked about the expert, if there's a jury, that the expert is about two-thirds of their eye contact is with the jury, scanning the jury, looking for those nods, for that those puzzled looks to get the sense as to whether or not they're clear. Is that the same as your focus? So as the prosecutor leading this expert, is a lot of your focus on the jury as well? You're looking for those nods, or you're looking for those confused looks so you know what to ask for more clarification on?
Great question. Yes, I spend about two-thirds of my time looking at the jury as well. And I do that to make sure that my expert is effectively communicating. And so if I see that a juror has a puzzled look on their face, or sometimes they'll actually look at me to indicate they don't get it, then at an appropriate time, I'll just interject and I'll say, you know, I didn't quite get that. Could I get you to explain that one point one more time? And then I'll look back at that juror, and without fail, I'll get some sort of indication that they got it that second time. So yes, both the lawyer leading the evidence and the expert need to spend that valuable time with the jury, because that's who you're teaching. When I teach university classes, or when I teach any class for that matter, I'm always looking at the students, at the people who are taking the course, because it is from them that I get the cue that I've done what I've set out to do and that I can go on to the next point.
Excellent. Now, something that just came to mind, too, is from an expert in their preparation, when they're coming up with analogies or examples, is it helpful for them to practice speaking to people who know nothing about the topic rather than we tend to hang out with other people who have the same level of knowledge, and so our explanations are going to make perfect sense to them, but when we step in front of a jury who may not have that knowledge, so is it valuable to practice explaining it to people who might know nothing about it?
Absolutely. I recommend using what I call the neighbor approach. No matter how brilliant you are, no matter how complex your area of expertise is, you should be able to give your evidence to your neighbor who knows nothing about your area of expertise in such a way that your neighbor says, I totally get it. I understand what you did in this case, and I understand the opinions you've arrived at and how you got to those opinions. Not that they're going to understand the math necessarily, but they're going to get the big picture. So by using the neighbor test, if you speak in such a way and present in such a way that your neighbor is going to get it, then that's the way to do it. So yes, it's helpful to practice in front of colleagues, but your colleagues aren't going to be the people in the jury box.
Excellent. Now, are there some keys in presenting that opinion? So you gave some great elements from presenting the direct evidence. Are there some keys to the effective way to present or form that opinion?
Yes, there are. Everything that happens in an expert's involvement in a case and everything that happens in court is linear. So we start with an expert explaining how they got involved in a case, what they were asked to do. They take us through their methodology. And ultimately, for most experts, you're going to get to some sort of a conclusion. If you have taught well, then towards the end of your direct examination, you're going to give your opinion. And if you've taught well, a jury is already going to get there before you get there. They're totally going to understand it because they will appreciate how you got there. And so I'm a big fan of an expert not beating a jury over the head with the answer, but teaching them in such a way that the jury is really going like, duh, of course that's the conclusion because you've taught them how to do it. If I can use an example, Brian, I had occasion early in my career with another prosecutor to prosecute a high-profile murder in Alberta. It was the first murder where the only evidence against the defendant was DNA evidence. It was the murder of a cab driver in Banff. And we had our DNA expert on the witness stand for a week talking about DNA evidence and showing that there was no jury, showing the judge how to read auto reds, how to look at lane markers and identify DNA profiles. And we spent a lot of time doing that on practice auto reds. And I knew that the expert had done a good job because when he put the auto reds up matching the question samples in the cab that the murder took place in, with the auto reds showing the profile from the defendant, I saw the defendant's family crying because they had been taught so well by our expert that when they saw the auto reds on the screen, they could see the match. And so you want to be in that position that by the time you get to your opinion, the jury will already understand the data, how you got there, and when you give your opinion, they're going to say, I totally get that. I totally see how you would get that. When you present the opinion, present it in a way that is clear, that we can all understand it. If there's any qualifiers to an opinion, make sure you tell us the qualifiers. That takes the sting out of it in cross-examination. For example, an expert may say that the minimum speed of a vehicle at the time of the collision is 100 kilometers per hour. But there may be some qualifications to that opinion. And so by qualifying the opinion at the appropriate time, there's nothing to come out in cross-examination. We've already covered that.
Excellent. And it strikes me that if an expert was to continually think of themselves as a teacher rather than as an expert, that it would help with so much of this, with the language, the presentation, the storytelling. So a lot of great information, some great examples. Now, so you said that the direct evidence is the key, but following that, regardless of how good the expert feels, is they're going to face the cross-examination. So what are some strategies for successfully handling that cross-examination?
Sure. Well, before we get to strategies, perhaps I'll point out some of the key techniques that opposing counsel use in cross-examining expert witnesses, and then we can look at some specific strategies for dealing with that. One of the strategies is to make an opposing expert your witness. And so if opposing counsel can, they will try and turn the prosecution witness around so that they end up supporting an opposite position. That's a very lofty goal. I've certainly done that on occasion. So that's one strategy. And I'll talk in a moment how to resist those sorts of things from happening. They attack the field of expertise. They attack the witness's qualifications. They expose bias that a witness may have or allegedly have. They attack the factual foundation for the witness's evidence. They might change the hypothetical that was used in direct. They might have published material, a textbook, that they use to try and impeach the witness. That's a whole different strategy. They attack the witness by producing contrary material that witness has produced in the past. So these are broad techniques that are frequently used in cross-examination for the purpose of trying to take away from the value of what that witness has said while on the witness stand. So in terms of cross-examination, we're now at a point where we have a party with a competing interest, and how the defense approaches the witness depends on what evidence the witness has to give. So, for example, if the witness's evidence actually helps, I'll say the defense on the base that we're talking about a prosecution witness, if the evidence actually helps the defense, there's no need to attack the expert. If anything, you want to make them look even smarter and even better. If the evidence is neutral, same thing, they're not likely to go after the expert. If the evidence hurts the other side, then an interesting event occurs. The expert witness wants to be convincing and credible. The cross-examining attorney wants to somehow devalue that evidence. Questions are asked, questions are answered. Sometimes subtly, sometimes not, there's a battle for power and control. And if the cross-examining attorney has the witness under control, then the attorney's going to direct the flow of the testimony. They're going to accurately anticipate responses, and they're going to shape the feel and substance of the cross-examination. If the witness is in control, then the answers instead will conform to what the witness believes is true, not the suggestions of the attorney. They will accurately anticipate the questions, and the witness will be in control. So there's a struggle for power and control, and attorneys try and gain control in a number of ways. The tone of voice they use, perhaps a sarcastic tone of voice. They ask questions that theoretically call for a yes or no answer. They use facial expressions or gestures. They use eye contact to try and lock in a witness. Dramatic interpersonal posturing. These are all methods that lawyers use to try and control a witness, but there's so much that can be done by the expert witness to avoid that control. You can't avoid the questions, but how you deal with them is another thing. So one technique I encourage experts to consider is to look at the issue of time. Time seems to be controlled by the cross-examining attorney, and a skilled attorney seems to have complete control over the pace at which cross-examination occurs. Questioning may be slow, exposing witnesses in the evidence or laying a foundation for further questions, or rapid-fire questioning, taking a witness somewhere very quickly that they don't want to go. We tend to view time as being external to us, something we kill, spend, waste, pass, lose, save, or stall for, rather than being internal and in our control. If we understand that we can control our time on the witness stand, it has a significant impact on the type of cross that we get. So one thing is breathing. When you get that any question, don't immediately answer it. Take in a breath, let it out, let a couple seconds pass. That puts the witness in control of the pace of the replies and sometimes in control of the whole exchange. It also gives you a moment to think about the answer. When you do that, you will tend to slow down the pace at which you get questions. We don't want you to jump in and answer a question before it's even being asked. We see that happen from time to time where a witness knows what the question is and they're just itching to give the answer. When you do that, it leads to a poor transcript. You've got half a question, an answer, the other half of the question. It's rude to the attorney. It annoys the court reporter, and you may answer the wrong question. And you're also shooting yourself in the foot because you don't allow yourself any time to think. You end up speeding up the pace of your cross-examination rather than slowing it down. So take a few seconds before you give the answer. Let us know that you're thinking. You can do that by putting your fingers on your chin or clasping your hands together. We know when you're thinking. When you're ready to answer, lean forward, re-engage the attorney, wait a second, then give the answer. You're not going to do that if the question is, what is your name? But if it's something that requires some thought, take that thought. Also, on the topic of time, if an expert is asked a question that requires some research or some calculations, it's appropriate for the expert to ask for sufficient time to do the work. I've had many, many examples over the course of my career where an expert has been asked something that requires a calculation or requires some consideration. The witness stand isn't the place to do that. All the witness has to do, you don't ask the lawyer, you just turn to the judge and you say, Your Honor, I'd be happy to do that. It's going to take me 10 minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour, whatever it is. And you're going to be given the time. Then you go and do that when you're not under pressure. You do it by yourself. You come back and you give the answer. Another thing to consider in cross, another technique, we talked about eye contact in the context of direct examination. Cross-examination is different. A skilled attorney will try and ask closed-ended questions and will try to coerce the expert witness to have eye contact only with the attorney. Now, it's natural we tend to look at each other when we converse, but we don't want you to do that. If we go back to direct examination, we spend two-thirds of our time with the jury. And the way you do that is if the answer to the question you've been given is longer than a sentence, then you turn, face the jury, and you give them your narrative answer. You re-engage with the prosecutor, get your next question, do the same thing. In cross-examination, we do the same thing. When you get a question that allows for a narrative answer, disengage from the attorney, look at the judge or look at the jury, and give them the answer. Remember, they're the audience, not the lawyer. We don't really care about the lawyer, frankly. The focus is on the people who have to make decisions. What that does is, first of all, it annoys opposing counsel because it shows them that they're not able to control you, that you know your testimony, that you know who you're supposed to talk to, and they will avoid giving you questions if they can that call for a narrative answer, because the last thing they want you to do is talk to your friends on the jury yet again about the evidence that you are giving. This is something that requires some practice, but it is something that you can take full advantage of. And this gives you the opportunity in cross-examination to reiterate points you've made in direct examination or even accentuate them. So eye contact, an important thing. Don't get locked into eye contact with defense counsel. The focus is the audience, and that audience is not defense counsel. Another strategy to consider is coping with intimidation. Sometimes lawyers can be very intimidating during cross-examination. Sometimes they are that way because it has served them well in the past. Sometimes they want to put on a good show for their client, and sometimes they do it simply because they're jerks. So when you get aggressive, intimidating questions, there are a number of things that an expert witness can do. First of all, lower your voice so that your calmness is sharply juxtaposed with the demeanor of the attorney. You've got an aggressive, annoying attorney and a calm, cool, collected witness. The contrast is stark, and I can tell you who's going to score the points. It's not going to be the attorney. Sometimes you can restate the question so that you sort out the attack. Let's say in a driving context, an attorney says, "You've intentionally selected data to increase the speed of my client's vehicle, haven't you?" That's an accusatorial question. It can put a witness on the defensive. What a witness can do is simply rephrase it, take out some of the sting, and give an answer such as, "So what you're asking me is, have I misused the data to arrive at a speed that is not supported by the data?" "Absolutely not." You take the sting out, and you get to the real heart of the question. You can ask the attorney to rephrase the question. This invariably works, because if a lawyer gives you a really sharp, stinging, sarcastic question, if you ask them to do it again, it's just no fun, because all the good stuff was in the first question. So you're going to get the second question back, but it's not going to be as exciting, it's not going to be as dramatic, it's not going to be as effective. It's kind of fun to do that once in a while, even if you know exactly what the question is, because it throws the attorney off. Don't be bullied into giving a yes or no answer if that's not the full and proper answer, and I'll talk in a little bit about how you avoid that. Another thing to consider is understanding the question. Make sure you understand the question before you answer it. If you get that compound question, a question that has two or three parts, as lawyers are wont to ask, don't answer that question, because you're not sure what question you're answering. You may think you're answering part one. They think you're answering part two. A perfectly polite way is simply to say to the cross-examining counsel, "You've asked me two questions. Which question would you like me to answer?" And that's not being rude. What you're telling everyone is that you're paying attention. Another thing to consider, when you don't know the answer, tell us. Witnesses get in trouble by guessing. Just because you're an expert doesn't mean that we expect you to know everything. When an expert says they don't know the answer or that's beyond their area of expertise, we listen very carefully. We like it when an expert can draw a line and can say, "Beyond this line is something that's outside of my area of expertise." So an expert has an obligation to stay within their lane. Another thing an expert wants to be mindful of is avoiding ambiguous responses, saying things like, "I guess so," or "not that I'm aware of," because you're just inviting a lot of unpleasant questions after that. Another thing to look at is the notion of admit-deny. Admit-deny is a specific technique that can be used by expert witnesses to deal with a challenging question. And I'll set this out this way. The goal of cross-examination really is to reverse or limit the substance or impact of a witness's testimony. One way to achieve that is to pose questions that are designed to diminish the persuasiveness of an expert's opinion. And sometimes it takes an expert takes their evidence out of context, dwells on tangential issues, that sort of thing. Admit-deny is a helpful technique. Admit-deny works this way. If you get a question where you agree with part of it but strongly disagree with the main part of it, then you set up your answer using a dependent clause. So you get the question, and instead of saying "yes, but," or "no, but," because that is not going to work, you'll get cut off right away, you begin your answer by saying something like "while," or "although," or "I have two things to say about that," or "you're partly correct." That allows you to admit the small part that's correct, that's the admit step, and then you issue a strong denial for the part that you don't agree with. And that admit-deny technique is a very valuable technique. If I give this example, let's say we have an expert on the stand who's talking about fingerprints. And the question that comes to them is, you'd agree with me that fingerprint science is no longer considered reliable. A very weak answer would be yes, but, or no, but. A much better answer is to say something like, while there has been some controversy arising out of a U.S. case, in this particular case, that isn't an issue. And then you go on to give your 13 reasons why it's not an issue in this case. Lawyers hate when you do that because you don't fall for that bait. Admit-deny is a very powerful technique that allows you to admit the little thing, issue a strong denial, turn to your friends on the jury, and give them a full explanation 2, 3, 4 times till they stop asking you the questions. So I've seen that used many times. Very, very helpful. I would say that's a good smattering, Brian, of some of the techniques that can be used in cross-examination to make what might be an unpleasant experience into one that is, if not actually profitable, at the very least tolerable.
Excellent. A lot of really, really good information. Now, Jonathan, one thing you mentioned is feel like you have to get backed into giving a yes or no answer. You said you were going to expand on that a little bit. Can you talk a little bit about how we get out of that?
Sure. If you start out your answer by saying yes, but, or no, but, opposing counsel will almost always shut you down. And they're entitled to do that because you actually said yes. You've answered the question. Now, if the prosecutor is paying attention, they will either object and allow you to give the full answer. I would always object and allow you to give the full answer. Or they'll make sure they'll bring it up in reexamination. So when you get a question where you're inclined to say yes, but, or no, but, what that means is there's two parts to the question. There's a little part you agree with. There's a large part you don't agree with. And that's where that admit-deny technique comes in. So the yes is the small admission. The no is the expansive answer. And that's why you preface your answer by saying something like while or although, or I have two things to say about that, because you've told everyone that you're not going to give a one-word answer. You've got a longer answer to give. And that gets you out of yes, but, and no, but.
Excellent. Great explanation and a great use of that admit-deny technique. Now, can you talk a little bit about when there is an opposing expert? So what's the role of the expert witness when there's an opposing expert?
Sure. We sometimes get complacent. In my 30 years as a prosecutor, the number of times I've had opposing experts has been a small percentage. In most cases that I prosecute, I'm calling 3, 4, 5, 6 expert witnesses, and it isn't that often that we have opposing experts. So an expert may think, well, that's good. But really, it's not so good. Our game is better if we have an opposing expert, because it really keeps us on our toe. It's not just a lawyer checking into us. It's another expert. Now, that expert may not be as good as you, but it's another expert. When there is another expert, then the role of the prosecution expert is different, because we expect more of you. The very first thing that we will do when there's an opposing expert is, as soon as we get a report from that opposing expert, the very first person that I give that to is my expert. And I'll say, I want you to go through this report. Tell me the good points, the bad points, good science, bad science, areas of criticism, things you agree with. And we're entitled to that report as soon as we close the prosecution case. So there's some time to work on this. So step number one is you act as a consultant for the prosecutor, because you're doing the scientific analysis of that opposing expert's report. The next thing you do is, once you've provided that valuable feedback to the prosecutor, is we're going to have you sit in court and listen to the direct examination of the opposing expert. And we're going to have you, in advance of that, assist us with areas of cross-examination, assist us with research papers, publications, things we can put to that expert, point out errors, if there are errors, point out variances in opinion. So we'll have you in court to listen to the direct. And then after the direct, we'll take a break so that you can provide feedback on that direct examination and help us prepare for cross-examination. We'll have you listen to that. And then we will often bring our expert back to the witness stand to testify as a rebuttal witness. So we have the prosecution expert in the Crown's case, the defense expert in the defense case, and then if you have additional information to provide that is directly in response to what the defense expert has said, we'll call you back on the stand as a rebuttal witness. So when there's an opposing expert, it ups your game significantly because you've got another expert evaluating your work. They may or may not agree with you, but they're evaluating your work. And you now take on that role as a consultant where you are providing extremely valuable information to the prosecutor, because I know a lot about prosecuting and I know a lot about different areas of expertise, but I'm not an expert. So I'm always going to look to my expert to consult with me, to let me know areas of vulnerability, areas that I should be going after, with the confidence that my expert provides me the data that I need. So it's a very different role when there's an opposing expert, and a very valuable role. It's frankly a real compliment to a prosecution expert to know that there is an opposing expert, and when that opposing expert is not called. I've done many cases where there's been an opposing expert on the other side, and they're sitting in court, they're watching my expert testify, and they're never called to testify. The reason for that is because they would largely agree with what my expert has said, and while they may quibble with this or that, it's not enough for them to take the stand and give evidence. So very different role when there's an opposing expert, and it really ups your game.
Excellent. Great information. Now, is it common for an expert witness during a trial or during some part of their testimony to change their opinion?
It should be something that happens very, very rarely. Expert witnesses want to be honest, effective, and well-received, and most of the time those goals are achieved. On occasion, though, issues arise that make those goals more difficult to achieve. And one of the most ambitious things a cross-examining attorney can achieve is to make a witness change his or her mind. If it's a small point, little is gained. But if it's a major point, the expert's evidence can disintegrate. And so expert witnesses who testify frequently will sometimes run into situations where there's enormous pressure brought about by the cross-examining attorney to change their minds about an important aspect of their testimony. And the sources of that pressure could be hypothetical questions, the presentation of information that conflicts with the expert's findings, exposure of areas of scientific ignorance. And some witnesses may retract essential components of their evidence on the witness stand. Almost always, that's going to be wrong, because the conclusion of the expert witness should be based on their scientific or professional work. You shouldn't have new conclusions as a result of cross-examination. Experts who unnecessarily capitulate on the witness stand will tend to have a rather short career as an expert witness. So what if the questions in cross-examination are so probing that you begin to think, maybe I've made a mistake? It's wise to remember two things. The information that is being fed to you in cross-examination may be suspect. This textbook, this article, this study that are being put to you may not actually say that at all. It may be entirely out of context. And remember the true source of your conclusions. Remember all of the work you put into it. And that's where you get your conclusions from. If you're presented with information that is new, and you think that you need to consider it, don't give an opinion right away on the witness stand, because that's when you're leaving the courthouse and you're kicking yourself in the butt because you screwed up. Not in your original testimony, but in giving up in cross-examination. So that, again, is when you look to the judge and you say, Your Honor, I need a few moments to consider defense counsel's question. Could we have a few moments, please? That doesn't allow you to go and phone a friend, talk to the prosecutor. You can't talk to anyone because you're in cross-examination. But it gives you a moment to think about it, perhaps to review your report and give an informed answer. We're all entitled to an informed answer, not just one off the top of your head. So there will be pressure to change opinions. I've seen it done. I've done it myself. And when I can get an expert to change their opinion, it is powerful. I feel bad for the expert, but, I mean, that's the way it is. But it's something that we really want to avoid.
So if what's causing the expert to perhaps second-guess himself is something that's being tenured as a research or in this textbook or this says, it would be completely acceptable for that expert to ask for time to review that information before answering that? Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's a sneaky process, and that's referring an expert to authoritative texts and publications, and there's really a few different things that are part of that. Sometimes what an attorney will do is they will read to an expert something that appears to contradict them, and they'll read from a letter, a textbook, an article, or whatever. What the witness wants to do there is you always ask to see the document that the attorney is reading from. This may come as a shock, but not everything the attorney is reading is actually true, and not everything they're reading is actually a full sentence or in context. I've had a number of experiences where I've had opposing counsel reading something to a witness, and when the witness actually looks at it, or the witness actually knows that source, we realize that's not what it says at all. Either it never said that to begin with, or you've completely taken it out of context. So, number one, ask to see it and have a look at it. Another popular technique is where an attorney will ask you to look at something that's been read to you and read out a highlighted portion. You know, this isn't reading school. And so the answer is you turn to the judge and you say, Your Honor, I could read this passage out, but it's meaningless. In order for me to comment on this passage, I would need to read the full article or the chapter. Tell the judge, that's 20 pages. I'm going to need about 2 hours to do that. So if you're able to give me the break, then I can do that. There's no way the judge wants that. No one wants that. And defense counsel will typically back away. So often that passage that is read or that you're asked to read is completely out of context, and you're nervous on the witness stand. It's not a reading test, so you don't take the bait, and you look to the judge, and you tell the judge you need time to do that, and that reading it means nothing.
Excellent.
So those are a couple of ways that other publications can be used to try and get you to change your mind, but they're almost always tricks. And I don't say that in a mean way. Defense counsel are there to represent their client's abilities and sometimes their interests, and sometimes using trickery can be helpful. And if no one's paying attention, then they can score some significant points. That's why the expert has to be on the ball.
Great information, and there's obviously so much to this that, and like you say, there's so little training provided to most of us in how to do this, and you're bridging that gap. You've been filling that gap for a number of years. Can you talk about your website, the training that you offer? You have a great blog that provides some great information. So can you talk about where people can go to find out about the expert witness testimony course and sign up for your blog and get other information about the services that you provide?
Sure. What I'd suggest is going to my website, and it's Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, Hack, H-A-K.com, jonathanhack.com. And in terms of articles on there, I write about two things. I write about forensic video analysis law, and for our purposes, I write about expert witness testimony issues. On my website, you will also find information about the two different courses that I teach, and that is the Expert Witness Testimony course and then the Courtroom Testimony for Investigators course. And that provides information about the course. Anyone who's interested in attending or hosting the course can contact me through the website. Most of the teaching that I do is actually through hosting, where a police agency will contact me and say, we would like to host your course. And then they either pay for the whole course or they hold the course, and then they invite neighboring agencies to come and fill the spots, and that defers the expense. But that's the place to go to the website. I've written that website or created the website as a resource for the law enforcement community to get valuable information. And if they want to take the next step and get training, then there's information there as well on that.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that. And I would strongly encourage the listeners to the members of the Excellence Training Academy to go and spend time on Jonathan's website. There's a lot of great information. I wish that I had gone through that expert witness testimony course years ago. It would have helped me in so many different ways. So, Jonathan, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your time today. You're a very, very busy man, and I really appreciate you carving time out of your very busy schedule to do the interview. But more importantly, I want to thank you for your commitment to the law enforcement profession, your commitment to the criminal justice system, your 3 decades of service as a Crown prosecutor, and all the work that you've been doing in the field of education to educate people about these critical issues and to help us as a profession to better present evidence so that the triers of fact can make an educated decision on the guilt or innocence. So for everything that you have done, everything that you continue to do, for all of your service, I truly want to thank you for that.
Thank you, Brian. It truly is my pleasure, and I suppose I'll close by saying this, that my goal as a prosecutor has always been to find the truth and to achieve justice, whatever that justice may be, but we do that through finding the truth, and expert witnesses are central to getting at the truth.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that. And so for the members of the Excellence in Training Academy, as always, I would encourage you to let the information that Jonathan shared, and he shared a lot of great information, let that information simmer, percolate overnight, and then be intentional tomorrow. Sit down tomorrow and write out your greatest takeaways. What are the takeaways that you took from this, and what action steps are you going to take? And maybe one of those action steps is going on the website and signing up for the course, because there's a lot of great content, very reasonably priced program. So again, to the members of the Excellence in Training Academy, community, I thank you for your commitment to excellence both in and through training. And again, always remember to train hard, train smart, train with passion and purpose, and always be willing to dare to be great.